The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Well, folks, promised you last time that I was going to bring you more from the Commission on Narcotic Drugs 62nd Annual Session, and we will get back to that next week. Thing is that there were some things in the news I wanted to talk about, and I got the opportunity to talk to somebody I've wanted to have as a guest for some time now. Abraham Gutman is an opinion writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, so I think you'll like the show. On the phone with me now is Abraham Gutman. He is an opinion writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. You're the reason I noticed recently that Senator Karen Gillibrand, the New York Democrat, had introduced some legislation that would have put some severe limits on opioid availability, would have put some limits on prescribing ability, rather. There are some serious problems with that legislation. It appears you're not the only one who's been pointing this out to Senator Gillibrand, but I heard it from you first. So can you tell me what's going on? What's going on? What is Senator Gillibrand trying to do?
So first of all, thank you for having me. And a few days ago, Senator Kristen Gillibrand tweeted that to address the opioid epidemic, we must work to address the root causes of abuse. So the idea is that she's leaning into a narrative of the crisis that says the reason that so many people are now living with addiction is because so many people were prescribed opioids and then they took it, they got hooked, and that was how this started. So if we want to end the addiction, what you need to do is to end the reason people are starting the addiction, which is the availability of opioids prescribed by physicians. Which seems like a logical narrative, and we see a lot of people on both sides of the aisle taking this narrative to heart. We see a wave of books that are telling that exact narrative. As I broke my ankle, I went to a doctor, they gave me Percocet, they gave me OxyContin, and now I have addiction. But when we look at the data, when we unearth the real effects of opioids on people, we see that the statistics look a little bit different. That the vast majority of people who get opioids don't get addicted. Some 92% of chronic pain patients don't have a problem with opioid addiction, even though they take it almost every day. So this notion that the problem here is a drug that is, you know, so addictive that people taking it is such a big concern, it is problematic. And in reality, while there was a reckless prescription that was driven by a for-profit entity, Purdue Pharma, that spread false information about risks and about prescription stewardship and how to be a good prescriber, it is not the case that the heart of the issue is that by being exposed to opioids, we created a crisis. We created addiction. So the first fault of the bill is that it doesn't address the actual cause, because it comes out of a narrative that is not the narrative of why this crisis is happening right now. And so that's the one side of things. But then when we look at the practicality, what will happen if, you know, a lot of bills are misguided, a lot of bills don't hit the mark 100%, but a lot of them are also harmless, so, you know, why get upset? What the bill suggests, and I will say that I haven't read the actual text of the bill, and I don't believe that anyone outside of her and her co-sponsors' offices in the committee office in the Senate, because the text is not available online. But what we learned from the press releases on the bill from Senator Gillibrand's office is that it's a legislation that will limit prescription of opioids for acute pain to 7 days. And the way the senator frames it is, you know, if you have your tooth pulled, you don't need more than 7 days of opioids. And here we have a big issue with what is the definition of acute pain. So the way that Senator Gillibrand is using acute is as something that is mild, that's something that is small, that's something that is not that big. But in reality, acute pain is only defined by duration. So usually the literature defines acute pain as less than 3 to 6 months. So all acute means is that it will pass. So now let's imagine someone that has major spinal surgery after a major car accident. That's acute pain. Are we comfortable with saying 7-day prescription limit? That's the amount of pain killers that that person could get? I am not. So the issue here is that while a lot of people, including the senator, recognize that for chronic pain patients, prescription limits and you know guidelines that limit the availability of opioids has created a rise in suicide among chronic pain patients, a lot of people feel like here it's okay because what we're talking about is acute pain and not chronic pain. When in fact, acute pain says nothing about how mild or severe the pain actually is.
The news reports are saying that she's now said that she's open to improving the idea, that she's heard concerns. She's also, I should also mention, she's announced that she's run, that Senator Gillibrand has announced that she's running in for the Democratic nomination for president. How seriously should we take the, she says she's heard our concerns. Should we, do you think we're okay now? Or is that, what does that mean?
Well, I can only tell you how I read that. First of all, let me say that I applaud Senator Gillibrand for looking into the issue in the first place. We see a lot of senators, including people running for president, ignoring the fact that 70,000 people died last year and the year before and 64,000 the year before of overdose, many of whom have been opioid overdose, although not all. So I do applaud her for having interest in the topic, and we need more people, high-profile people that use platforms such as presidential campaigns to talk about this issue. So that's a good thing. When Senator Gillibrand, I don't know her, I believe her. If she says that she's listening, I believe, and that means that this is our time not to step back away from the critique, but to lean into it because she says that she's listening. So let's have her let something to hear, right? So I think that this bill cannot be corrected or amended to be a good bill. And the reason is that a prescription limit is not how medicine should work. If you are concerned that doctors aren't practicing prescription stewardship that is responsible and they don't know how to prescribe opioids, require training, education. Get those doctors to a place that people in America know that when they go to a doctor, they get good care. The solution is not to legislate how doctors behave. And I don't understand how doctors are not deeply offended by this bill. Because what basically this is saying is you're all misbehaving. I don't trust you. I'm going to impose a limit because I don't think you're capable of change. I'm not saying that all doctors are perfect. I can't tell you that a lot of places have played around with, you know, what is the minimum order? What is the standard order? If you just, you know, what is the default order on the computer in the hospital's record system? All of those nudges are good. Let's help doctors prescribe better. Let's help doctors reduce prescription when it's unnecessary. But saying that we're going to legislate medicine to that level of interaction between doctor and physician, physician and patient, I'm sorry. So when a doctor said, you need 8 days, then a bill says, Congress says, no, you can't. That is very problematic to me. And so I don't think this bill can be improved. I think it is unnecessary. And I think it oversteps the boundaries of a healthy relationship between physician and patient.
Kind of radical, letting doctors handle questions and decisions about healthcare. I don't know. But, it's just one. I mean, I've been following this war on pain patients for the last, oh my God, it's been 20 years. And, I mean, we just keep seeing, you know, let's put more restrictions on, Yes, but now if people really, I don't know. And then it gets to the other, root causes. there are thousands of those opiate overdoses, of those that are suicides. Many more than we want to admit are actually suicides. I mean, what root cause are you addressing if all you're doing is taking away the tool that the person uses to kill themselves? I mean, that's not a root cause. That's
And about that, I think that gets close to like a really important point, that we did see a major reduction, and some of this is positive, of opioid prescription in the past, you know, two decades or decade. And I believe there was a 20% decrease between 2006 and 2017. That's a big decrease. So one in five prescriptions wasn't written. At the same time, we see that overdose deaths are more than doubled from opioid overdose deaths. So if you have a major back surgery and you can't get a Percocet or a painkiller that will help with your pain, and opioid is not always the right medication for you, but it is sometimes. If you live in Philly, buying heroin is really easy. And that's dangerous. That is what we want to avoid. And when someone takes a Percocet, we know what they're taking, we know how much they're taking, and we know to follow that. When someone uses heroin from the street, is it heroin, is it fentanyl, is it carfentanil? How strong was it? How much was it? What white powder, was it, you know, a lot, a little? We don't know. So the risk of overdose, the risk of, by the way, skin wounds, abscess, obviously HIV, hepatitis C, and all increase when you transition from this regulated medical care world into an illicit and criminalized market when we don't have enough services to support it and reduce harm in it.
This is my interview with Abraham Gutman from the Philadelphia Inquirer. We will be back with that in just a moment. This is Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. You've got limited time, and I want to get to a couple of other things while I've got you on the phone, because, as I said, you're an opinion writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Philadelphia has been in the news quite a lot for very good things for once. Your city is one of a growing number around the country where people are trying to set up a supervised consumption site, safe injection site, overdose prevention site. In Seattle, they were calling them community health engagement locations. I don't care what the euphemism is. These things work. SIFs, supervised consumption sites, they work. Your city has come about as far as anybody, possibly further. You've got the people at City Hall seem to be in favor. You've got the Department of Justice scared because they've actually filed a lawsuit to try and stop you. Tell me about what's happening in Philly. Tell the listeners about what's happening in Philly, because this is just so exciting.
Yeah, so Philadelphia has the highest overdose death rate of any large city in America. It's very a very disparaging sight. The epidemic or the crisis takes two forms. One is with, you know, among a population that is also homeless, that is visible, that we see, you know, public injection, and that becomes an issue for neighborhoods and a nuisance, and people are scared that it has public safety implications. At the same time, we have 75% of people who dying at home alone, so we have this hidden overdoses, oftentimes in their own home, and if there was someone with naloxone, an opioid reversal medication, then the death would have been avoided. So the idea of a safe consumption space or site, or again, as you said, there are many many names that advocates and researchers call this, is to understand that the treatment of an opioid overdose, of that moment, not of the addiction as a whole, just that moment, is rather simple. There's a medication, it's called naloxone or Narcan, and by using it and with CPR skills, a lot of people who died from an opioid overdose don't need to die. But what that requires is not using alone. The problem is that in a world with a war on drugs, using alone makes sense. Because you don't want the cops to see you, because you don't want maybe your family to know, your employer to know. You don't want, if you're in a vacant house, you want to use really fast because you don't want anyone to maybe, you know, attack you, rob you, what have you, and things that could happen, you know, in some places that are pretty scary for the people in addiction. So you're more likely to use fast. You're more likely to use in an unsafe way. You're more likely to not notice how much you're using. And you're more likely to practice unsafe injection practices, which also cause, you know, skin problems, wounds, and all heart infections, all what have you. All of those things are not related to opioids. So heroin doesn't cause a wound in your arm. Heroin isn't the culprit of heart infections. What is, you know, the speedy injection. What is the unclean water that you use with in the process, or the unclean surface of your skin when you inject. So what if we have a room, and that's all it is? People, you know, go really far and beyond with their fears, but what if we just have a room where people can come in a well-lit environment with a, by the way, with a syringe biohazard trash can, so you can also dispose of the syringe after you use it, and you can use drugs in a place that if something happens to you, someone can respond, in a place where you have wipes for alcohol for your skin, you have clean running water, you have a mirror so you can, you know, inject safely and, you know, be responsible with yourself and your own body. And maybe you have fentanyl testing strips that you can check to know how much to use, because if it's fentanyl, you'll maybe use less or slower than if it's heroin. So all of these wraparound services that, when in a criminalized market, we don't know what is the substance and you need to use in a fast and dangerous ways, a safe injection site prevents. And most importantly, there'll be someone on site that has naloxone, so if you do overdose, you can be revived. This is not a very complicated concept, right? But for some reason, there's a lot of debate, mainly among law enforcement and politicians, and not so much among academics, on whether or not this is it will work. Well, it works. There's 120 of those around the world, and none of them, anyone ever died. Because again, if you hit an overdose quickly with Narcan, your odds of success are very, very high. So last year, in last January, Philadelphia, representatives of the mayor, district attorney, police, and health commissioners came and said, we're giving a green light for someone else to do this. We're not going to give public money. We're not going to do it ourselves. But if anyone wants to do this in our city, we'll work with them, and we will support with wraparound services. The DA said we won't charge them. The police said we won't arrest them. Then there was a lot of community outcry. What will happen? It will raise crime. It will raise drug use in these neighborhoods. The studies from all around the world suggest that that is not the case. And actually, it reduces public injection and reduces drop syringes. So folks in neighborhoods that now have those problems, which we can all agree no one wants their kids walking to school and seeing a person inject heroin, or playing in a playground that has syringes and drop needles on the floor, then this is also a solution for them, right? Like, everybody wins. But still, we have this big discussion, and a lot of people are not in favor. A lot of council members are not in favor. But in the summer, former governor, Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, decided to incorporate a nonprofit called Safe House that will open the first one in the United States, the first safe injection site that they call overdose prevention sites. A few months go by, and there's a lot of question of what will happen. And then the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, a Trump nominee, has decided to file a lawsuit against Safe House to prevent them from ever opening. So this is where we are right now. Yesterday, there was big news that they found a location. in a neighborhood called Kensington, which is considered in many ways to be the epicenter of the crisis. So that made, that was expected. I personally and a lot of others hope that there will be multiple around the cities. So, you know, again, this will be good for everyone because in a lot of neighborhoods, there are drop syringes, and a lot of neighborhoods, there are people in addiction that need these services. So the more we have, the more the neighborhood in Kensington won't necessarily feel like, again, we're throwing these problems at them, which is definitely a feeling that exists there. So they found a location. The lawsuit needs to go on. The argument of the DOJ is that safe injection site falls under the crack house statute, which the statute says that any place that is intentionally operated, owned, what have you, for the purpose of using, selling, distributing, manufacturing drugs is illegal under federal law. It's kind of obvious that they didn't have a public health intervention in mind when the crack house statute was written originally. So now is the question whether or not they will, the federal judiciary will see the crack house statute as covering a public health intervention. And I'm hopeful that the solution, what will actually happen here is that maybe accidentally the U.S. attorney will give us the path of a judge saying, no, this is legal, go for it, and essentially legalize it from the bench. But we're a few steps from there.
Everywhere. I mean, I've been running some stuff from the Commission on Narcotic Drugs on the show recently. And with the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, it feels like we're consistently hearing that human rights and public health, those have to stay on the back burner because what's most important is that we create a drug-free world. And so once we get everybody to fall in line and just stop doing all these drugs and stop selling and stop growing and all that stuff stops, then we can worry about things like human rights and public health. And as stupid as that sounds, for some reason there are people who go along with that in the the Department of Justice, for instance, at the moment. Now, this is the first they've made this argument before that, oh, this is a violation. We'll do something. They've spoken up a couple of times as the debate over safe injection sites has gone on in this country. We heard it up in, I think, Vermont was one. But the U.S. attorney there in eastern Pennsylvania, was the one there in Philly, is actually filing suit. What's been the public reaction?
I think we can't be naive. A lot of people are happy, right? A lot of people think this is a good thing, that this is just, you know, enabling addiction, that this is coddling drug users. There's a lot of, by the way, racial grievances in here, which is completely understandable. Oh, now that white people are dying from opioids, you suddenly read different interpretations into the crack house statute, which is called colloquially the crack house statute because it cracked down on people using crack, which were predominantly black and brown people. So it's the politics of safe injection sites are, and harm reduction in the opioid crisis in general, are very complicated because of the tormented history and present of the drug war and the disparate impact, I will say not even disparate impact, and the purpose of it as being a means of control of people of color. So although not all people who are dying are white, although the fastest rate growth rate of overdose death in Philadelphia, for example, is Latinx folks, we still hear that this is a solution that came in mind for white people, which in many ways is true. Like, there's no doubt in my mind that because the magnitude of the overdose crisis, more and more people who, you know, maybe are judges, maybe are city councilors, maybe are people who just work in administration, have more social capital, suddenly have met this personally and like, oh, my friend's son, he wasn't a moral failing. He was, you know, a victim of addiction. So the attitudes definitely also changed at the same time because of race and because of who is dying. But that also leads to this backlash of, then we don't want to see it. We don't want you now, like, go, why don't you go arrest them? So it's complicated because I think the grievance makes perfect sense. At the same time, I do think that safe consumption sites could be done in a way that are inclusive. And a classic example is moving away from safe injection, which to a lot of people signals people using heroin, white people, although that's not exclusive at all. when we can move to safe consumption and talk about smoking tents and talk about, you know, there are safer ways to use any drug, including smoking crack. So how do we move towards that is a really big question. So the coalition is not there yet. That said, people are dying and we don't need to wait for the coalition to happen. And we need to move forward, we need to save lives, we need to at the same time work to have conversations and educate about facts, but we can't wait to have a big reconciliation moment between the drug warriors, the folks who are still very, very hurting from criminalization of them as black and brown bodies in this country, and folks who are dying in addiction, who are, you know, also come from all walks of life. I can also say that the recovery community has been pushing back a lot. A lot of folks recovered through 12-step and abstinence-only models, which worked for them, and that's amazing, but recovery is, you know, nonlinear, and each person has their journey, and there's no right and wrong way. So whatever recovery means to you, that should be our goal, that everybody's safe and well. So a lot of people say, you know, I recovered through 12-step, I recovered with that abstinence only, don't do this, I needed to meet my rock bottom by providing safe consumption spaces, you won't let them meet theirs. That the 70,000 deaths last year show that for a lot of people, rock bottom is death. So we need to, the coalition is not there 100% yet.
Again, I know that you've got, I've taken up a lot of your time so far today, and I'm grateful as heck to you. Again, folks, we're speaking with Abraham Gutman. He is an opinion writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. There's a lot happening in Philly, a lot happening around the U.S., and I am just really glad that, Abraham, I'm really glad that you've decided that you're taking an interest in this stuff and that you're writing about it. Bridget Stuff, you do some good work. Now we can find your stuff. We can find your writing at philly.com, obviously. Mm-hmm. But social media, and of course, any closing thoughts for the listener.
So first of all, thank you for having me, and I would always love to have the conversation continue. My best way to reach me out is on Twitter at @ABGUTMAN, Abraham Gutman. DMs are open. Let's talk. And my closing thought is that this is a fight worth fighting. So if it's a fight for pain patients, it's a fight for patients that have acute pain, and if it's a fight for the people who are currently in addiction and need harm reduction and a safe place to be, these are all worthy fights. So I hope that as many people can join in, and as this election progresses, that more people can ask the question of their candidates, representative, from City Hall to the President of the United States, and make this an issue. Because if 70,000 Americans died in any other way, a preventable death, I doubt this wouldn't have been the number one story of our time. But 70,000 Americans died last year, more than the entirety of the Vietnam War, for the third year in a row, and we're not talking about it. So let's do everything we can to change that.
That was my interview with Abraham Gutman, opinion writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And that's it for this week. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.